company. Narayana, who's going to tell us something about quantum electrodynamics with massless fermions in three dimensions.
Thank you. First of all, double thanks to the organizers. One, for having an in-person conference. I'm tired of Zoom, and the many-body interaction is not there when you're in a Zoom meeting. And the other thing is I can now even talk on Blackboard, so I don't have to go through everything I wrote down here. If you ask questions and I don't complete it, that's okay. I try to say what I want to say in the beginning, and then whatever I get to say is whatever I get to say. Okay. I come from a particle theory background, but I'm not a phenomenologist. I'm primarily someone who does lattice gauge theory as a way to get at non-perturbative physics in relativistic quantum field theory. Today, I'm going to present some results in three dimensions, but I would rather motivate starting from four, because by four, I mean four Euclidean, which is three plus one, but the plus one doesn't matter because I'm not going to go away from Euclidean at all in the talk. I understand four dimensions better. Three dimensions, there are things that still bother me. The reason why I decided to do three dimensions is I wanted to try to understand scale invariance in a lattice setup. And scale invariance is really difficult to do on the lattice, as I will explain. And I thought maybe three dimensions will be easier than four. Okay. My idea is, I don't have to write this on the board, my idea is to say how one goes about trying to study theories that are potentially scale invariant without an a priori knowledge of whether they are or not. So we don't want to be biased. And I can already say that based on questions that were asked yesterday, particularly by Shailesh, I always assume there is a continuum theory. And by that I mean a theory where correlation functions in the continuum are known for all separations, separations going to zero all the way to separations going to infinite. Okay? At every point, it's continuum. So in that sense, the lattice has gone away, strictly speaking, at all scales. Right? That's one thing, and I will tell you how we go about doing this. And at the end of the talk, I will talk about a model where it is not possible to do this, yet it's interesting to study that model. So it always sits on the lattice. And it's a what we call as a lattice-conformed model, where the lattice spacing cannot be taken to zero. There is no mechanism to do that. Okay. It's always a fermion gauge system. That's what I will talk about for the entire talk. And all the interest is in the fermionic sector. The gauge sector is not so interesting from my viewpoint in the talk. So let me just talk about the technical detail first as to how we implement fermions in a lattice setup so that all the symmetries are properly respected, and why that causes some problems when you try to do numerical simulations. I will not talk anything about numerical simulations, the technical details throughout the talk, except to say that we do standard, the weighting where important sampling is done, and we calculate observables based on important sampling, and our results are all numerical, which means if you ask me for proofs, like, are you sure this is what it is? I will say, well, within this error, I know that's what it is. Okay? All right. So let me start by talking about what's called as the, I'll put this on this side because this part of it we probably will need over and over again. my aim is not to derive anything about the overlap Dirac operator, but just to talk about the properties. It's a way to realize chiral fermions on the lattice. Chirality becomes parity in three dimensions. So it's a way of realizing the parity anomaly on the lattice. Okay. And the operator, which I will put an O in the bottom, and I will always talk about it for the most part massless, and it is strictly massless on the lattice. The V is a unitary operator. It's taken from the Wilson-Dirac operator by making the unitary part of it. Okay. Just so people are clear as to what I'm talking about, the Wilson kernel, I will talk about it in four dimensions first, but it will be trivial to convert it into three. Looks like that. The Wilson mass, for people, there are probably only two or three in the audience who will get confused by this. The Wilson mass, I have put it as a positive number, but because I put a negative number, it's really a negative Wilson mass. Yeah. So in the conventional way of doing QCD, I am talking about fermions with negative masses, not positive masses. The C is the naive Dirac operator. So that looks like that. And the T mu is just the parallel transporter. And B is the Wilson term, which looks like this. The T mu acting on psi of x is the parallel transporter. Of the matter field when you shift it this way. Okay. Now, even though this is the Dirac operator, the propagator is this. So it's not just obtained by the inverse. And the reason is because in deriving this, you have done a trick that is not normal to field theory. Field theory, you either say, I want to do it in the operator formalism, and everything is operator, or you say you want to do it in the path integral formulation, everything are fields. But what's done here is, the gauge fields are treated in path integral, but the fermions are treated in the operator formalism. So this is the result that you get after you have taken care of the operator formalism and done the many-body theory of the fermions and obtained an effective operator for the fermion determinant and an effective operator for the propagator. It's still quadratic in the sense that's all information you need in a gauge field background, what the fermion determinant is and what the fermion propagator is, and then you're done. Okay, now, the next thing I want to do is actually talk about some properties of this which become relevant for the discussion today. So the V, in the case of, so this is specifically in the case of four dimensions, right? The V can be written as gamma phi times epsilon of H omega, right? Where the H is nothing but gamma phi. So you have an extra Dirac-Cobb matrix in four dimensions, the gamma phi, which you can use to take the Wilson-Dirac operator and make it Hermitian. And this literally means the epsilon symbol, which means all the positive eigenvalues of HW go to plus one, all the negative eigenvalues go to minus one. Yeah? Then you can write H overlap, which is gamma phi D0, that becomes gamma phi plus epsilon over 2. This is a nice formula because you see, this is a gamma phi that's independent of the gauge field. And this is a gamma phi that depends on the gauge field. And you are trying to compare the two, right? And the operator that is of relevance is just gamma phi plus epsilon over 2. And it has all the information you need. Okay. Now, without going through much of the derivation, I want to get the main point across. So H naught square, you will see, commutes with gamma phi, which means eigenvalues of H naught square, which I will call psi I plus minus, is going to take this form. Yeah, so they are simultaneously diagonalized, and for every chiral partner, you have the same eigenvalue of H naught square. Now, when you work this out, all that says is the epsilon of H is just cosine theta I sine theta I. With theta I in minus pi to pi. Yeah? Yes, Shreli.
You're with me. So, just for people in the condensed matter audience,
yeah,
I think what you're doing is to start with a five, you're in four dimensions.
No, it's all four dimensions.
Yeah, so I'm just going to make a comment and you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
If you start with a five-dimensional, what I think they call the topological insulator, on the walls of that topological insulator, which is a four-dimensional space, there would be left and right chiral fermions. And if you can write down, let's say, the path integral in the background of a gauge field and integrate out all the bulk thing and keep just the physics of the walls, that's the physics you're trying to explain here. Is that fair?
Yes. So,
just to make that connection with the audience.
That's right. That's exactly correct. The thing that I'm trying to avoid here, mainly for the need of time, is not give the history of it. But you're absolutely correct. We won't need that. I mean, if it helps understand some physics, that's great, but we won't need it for my talk.
Because I talk to many of my friends and they would want to see that connection between the two.
Yeah. That's exactly correct. So, as I said, the fermions are treated as many body, and this is a ground state. And if you say there is a ground state, then you have automatically have a fictitious time and you have projected onto the fictitious time a t going to infinity. Yeah, that is true. Only the ground state of that many body operator matters. Everything is based on the ground state. The excited states don't matter at all. They don't come into the picture at all. Yeah. So this is the generic case, right, where there is, please ask questions. Otherwise, I'm not sure if I'm making any sense or not.
This comment is helpful, but somehow I actually got more confused.
Yeah.
I thought at the end you are talking about a four-dimensional Euclidean space system. And
yeah, so the theory is going to live in four Euclidean dimensions.
But I think at the end your purpose is to study a 3+1 dimensional quantum system.
What do you mean? What's the difference between 3+1 and 4?
That's Minkowski.
Oh, no, I'm not going to go into Minkowski at all.
Okay.
No. Everything I say will be in Euclidean. So I'm implicitly assuming that we have computers that have infinite power and I can get the complete spectrum of the theory.
Okay. So that's why you are saying this is really a quantum system living in four space dimensions. And it can be viewed as the boundary of some 4+1 dimension topological insulator, although I don't have to think of that. It can just be viewed as a quantum system in four dimensions.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And that's all I will need. But I think Shailesh is bringing up a point, which is
from some confusion, because all of this thing formulation is clear to us. And
yeah.
Sure that
so here my aim was only to give the formulas, not the derivation. Okay.
I want to ask one more question. So here we're using operators to describe the fermionic sector.
Sorry?
We're using operators to describe the fermionic sector. So I want to clarify the structure of the Hilbert space. Can you write down, say, a complete basis of this Hilbert space? A set of complete basis of the Hilbert space.
Well, so for me, everything is finite. Every operator is finite.
But do you impose gauge equivalence relation?
Sorry?
Do you impose gauge equivalence relation?
So I haven't talked about gauge symmetry yet.
Yeah.
So when I say that it is finite, I mean that I am on finite space.
Yeah.
But there is gauge copies of it in that finite space. So I integrate over all gauge copies. And it may be trivial in the sense it's gauge invariant, so I only have to deal with, you know, one sample in a particular sector.
Okay.
Yeah?
It's like you are doing some gauge fixing here?
I don't have to. In lattice gauge theory, that's the nicest thing. We don't have to gauge fix at all. We just sample, and at every point, you are somewhere. You know, you've picked one representative over a gauge equivalence, and it doesn't matter which representative you pick, the answer will come out right.
Yeah, but you consider them to be all equivalent. They represent the same physical state.
Yeah.
Okay.
I suspect you are, maybe your question is a little bit deeper than what you're saying. So maybe you want to ask it again. Yeah. At a trivial level, yes, they are all gauge equivalent.
Okay.
Yeah. They are all gauge equivalent. Yeah. Yeah. And you see, the moment I write this, let me complete the formulas because it's useful. The unitary operator, of course, looks like this. Okay, and the overlap Dirac operator looks like that. So you see, for me, it's not only true that I am in a finite lattice, everything is bounded. There is a maximum eigenvalue and a minimum eigenvalue. So I'm working with a system that is very well defined. There are no infinities of any sorts. Yeah? Okay. Now that's the generic case. If this is all, this is all it was, things should have been easy and we should have no problem. But there is a special case which I want to talk about, which is the case. So by I mean, of course, the block sectors, right? So I have block diagonalized the Dirac operator into blocks of two, and the I labels each block, right? There could be a block where theta I is zero. There could also be a block where theta I is pi. Yeah? These are degenerate blocks. These are degenerate blocks in the sense the epsilon looks like gamma 5 here, and epsilon looks like minus gamma 5 here. V looks like 1 here. V looks like minus 1 here. D0 looks like 1 here, and D0 looks like 0 here. Yeah? So there are degenerate blocks like this. When you have degenerate blocks like this, there is no reason why I have to pick both of these here or both of these here. Instead, I can take this and split it differently and say epsilon is 1, and I bring back the HW just to emphasize. The V looks like gamma 5, and the D0 looks like that, or the epsilon looks like minus 1, V is minus gamma 5, and D0 is 0001. Yeah? So this sort of, all I did is, if there is degeneracy, I can write it like this. And in this way of writing it, you see, I have one mode whose eigenvalue is 1, which would be considered ultraviolet, high momentum, right? And one mode where it's an eigenvalue of 0. And I'm now going to show you that it's robust. The difference between the two options is whether the 0 mode is negative chirality or whether the 0 mode is positive chirality. Yeah? Whether I pick this or this, I get the interesting property if I take one half of that, that is plus or minus 1. Right? If I pick this, I get 1. If I pick this, I get minus 1. Because all of these, the trace is 0. So when theta I is not equal to 0, you're guaranteed that the epsilon is traceless. That means for every positive. So it's a proper representation of gamma 5, if you wish. But when there is degeneracy, you can split that and you can have an epsilon that is either identity or the minus the identity, and you get this.
So this is about resolving this step at zero.
I'm going to get to that. That's crucial, and I'm going to get to that now. So now you see, I can sort of say that this degeneracy. Do you have a question too? No? Okay. So this degeneracy could happen many times. If it happens many times, this in general can be Q, where Q counts the number of times this happens for a particular gauge field. Now I'm going to show you that it can happen for gauge fields, and once it happens, it's robust. Yeah? So, now let me assume the gauge field is UN. Yeah? If the gauge field is UN, then you can, suppose if you have U in some link on the lattice, gauge fields live on the link collecting x and x plus mu. This is u mu of x, and this belongs to un, right? I can always diagonalize this, right? I can always say it is r e to the I phi r dagger. Yeah? Actually, I'm now talking about extremely old argument. This argument, I believe, was the argument that was brought up when Mike Kreutz gave a talk in the mid-70s in Princeton, and David Gross and Callan, Kurt Callan and all these people were in the audience, right? This is a proof, now you'll see, that lattice is wrong. But we are going to now show that that argument isn't quite right. You know, physicist proofs always means that there's just a way around it. You have to fix it, right? So if this is true, right, which means I can talk about a U mu of Q, which is R e to the I Q phi R dagger, right? This also belongs to UN, right? Where I'm assuming all of these are in minus pi to pi. And Q itself, I'm going to assume, is in the range 0 to 1. Yeah? So I am continuously then able to deform every link variable to unity, which means independent of what gauge field configuration you give me on the lattice, finite lattice, there is a continuous parameter that connects me to U equal to 1, which is free fermion, right? Now, if you now say that, sorry?
Why do you say it's the unit matrix?
Oh, no, no. I put in a little q in front. You see, when q equal to 0, it's a unit matrix.
I mean, it's just a bunch of phases, right, if I diagonalize it?
Yes, that's correct. So it's a bunch of phases when I diagonalize it. Now I put in a free parameter in front of the bunch of phases. And this is a new link variable now, right? Now, the new link variable gives me a continuous set of gauge field configurations. Continuous, not necessarily differentiable. But we never talk about differentiability on the lattice, right? We can only talk about continuity on the lattice. So I have given you a procedure to talk about a continuous set of gauge field configurations so that you give me something, I will continuously deform it to the trivial configuration. Because you see, when I put q equal to 0, rr dagger is 1, right? Very strange, but correct. I know why, if you haven't seen this argument before. Yeah, it's puzzling.
So it's just the deformation of the usual theory
of this parameter q? Not a theory, just a gauge field configuration, one gauge field configuration. I just took one gauge field configuration and then said that now I consider all gauge field configurations because I'm supposed to integrate over every one of them, right? So before I do any important sampling, all gauge field configurations are relevant, right? So all of these for every q is something that is in the path integral, right? Okay, so now, but let's say that trace of epsilon h of q equal to 1 was, say, just say, let's say it's 1 for now, to simplify the argument. But I know is 0. Right? At q equal to 0, it's trivial. A trivial gauge field configuration, the spectrum can be, of the fermions can be easily solved. They come in pairs. You know, there are no special cases. And you find it is 0. Which means, somehow, this is what Shailesh was alluding to moments ago, it has to go from 0 to 1. Yeah? So if it has to go from 0 to 1, right? If I say this is 0, this is 1, this is q, right? And I now write the spectrum of HW, right? The HW spectrum sort of is going to look equal number here, but here I should have, so if I put 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and I put 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, and then a 4, right? That's what's to happen to give me this epsilon of 1 at q equal to 1, right? So in that sense, what should have happened is something like this should have happened. Right? So there must be a configuration in the middle where I cannot define epsilon. Right? That must be true. Or there is no solution to this. Here is the interesting thing. If I perturb the gauge field a little bit, all that is going to happen is this is going to move around a little bit. Where it crosses will move, but the robustness of this will stay.
So this is like a spectral flow
argument. It's like a spectral flow argument, and it rigorously shows that there are configurations with different q's on a finite lattice. I don't mean continuum. Everything finite. Finite number of lattice points. Right? So the spectrum is V times 4n. Right? And it's not equal. It's split. And there are configurations. And the only catch is, somewhere in the middle this has to happen. Right? Okay. So I want to now give a different argument for the same thing, which helps us understand what it means for this Q to be continuum physics. And that's where we will have to depart a little bit in three dimensions. And that's where I get confused in three dimensions. I don't get confused in four, but I get confused in three, right? The same logic, instead of talking about Q, I can talk about epsilon as a function of m. So now I'm not doing a deformation of the gauge field, but I am looking at the spectrum of the Wilson operator as a function of this mw. Yeah? Now, I won't go through the proof. We are interested in this from 0 to 2. I won't go through the proof, but you can easily show that there cannot be any level crossings here. Yeah. So what we know is that we pick an MW. I don't know what we picked. Maybe we picked MW equals 1, right? And then we found 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 here, but only 4 here. But I can rigorously show that this stays phi, and it stays phi all the way up to here. Okay? It just comes from the positivity of this operator. It just comes from the fact that the Wilson mass term that you put in is positive, right? So which means nothing can happen on what is usually called as the physical mass side, right? And then what happens probably is this crosses, this goes like that, this goes like that, this goes like that, and this goes like this. So now, instead of the level crossing that has happened at some parameter q between the trivial gauge field configuration and the configuration that we're interested in, it's happened at some mw. No, this is, no, no, no. This is still in 4D. This is still in 4D, except that my continuous parameter is not q. I'm just fixing the gauge field configuration and continuously varying the Wilson mass. Right? Okay. Now, the question is, what happens when you do a perturbed configuration? When you do a perturbed configuration, this will move a little bit, but this will not move. But now comes continuum physics. What happens if I put an instanton of a physical size? What do I mean by the instanton of a physical size? I take, yeah, I have 5 minutes. Okay, I'm going to finish this part and then I'll be done. So what do I mean by instanton of a physical size? By instanton of a physical size, I mean I take the solution that Tuft gave us. I take that solution and then literally put it on the lattice, right? Okay, I'm going to assume that it is an L to the fourth lattice, right? And the instanton size is in such a way, let me call it dimensionless, rho times 1 over L sort of is the instanton size, right? Now, what will happen is that so let me draw a picture here, a sort of a cartoon of the instanton. So this is my minus L and this is my plus L, right? And my instanton is like that, right? When I take L bigger and bigger and bigger, right, my instanton stays fixed. That means I am sampling more points. So I am doing a finer sampling of the instanton, right? So this is where I put it, and when L gets bigger and bigger and bigger, this instanton sits there the same way and it gets more points. When that happens, what will happen is this point will go to zero as capital L goes to infinite. Yeah? So that you can rigorously see. So if there is any physical topological object, when you take the continuum limit, I will talk about continuum limit in detail after the break, the crossing will get closer and closer to zero, and it should not matter what value of MW you pick here, you're going to get the same physics. So MW sort of becomes a regulator parameter, and the answer should not depend upon MW. Some lattice effects might depend upon, lattice spacing effects might depend upon MW, but all the continuum results will become independent of MW. Yeah? So, now, this is what happens, but then you can do something else. You can take, let's say, SU2 gauge theory, pure SU2 gauge theory. Pick a lattice coupling, generate important sampling, and ask, what happens to the crossings, right? Do you see as you take the continuum limit, all the crossings go to zero? It turns out that's not the case. That's not the case, and even in the continuum limit, there are what are called as instantons of the size of the lattice, and they do exist in the continuum limit, And the burden then is on a dynamical calculation to show that instantons of size zero do not matter when it comes to physics. Yeah? Everything I said here goes to three dimensions, three Euclidean dimensions. What's the difference? The only difference is that I don't have this gamma 5. Because I don't have this gamma 5, I don't have this logic. Because I don't have this logic, I don't have a concept of topology. Right? So, because there is no concept of topology, we have to now ask, what happens if you decide to put a monopole? Yeah? That's the next thing that I want to talk about. But let me just briefly say one thing to end this part of the talk, which is another property of this epsilon, right? So I alluded to the fact that there is a many-body problem in the background, which you can think of as sort of a many-body Hamiltonian like that, where these are fermion creation and elation operators, right? And as Shailesh already remarked, the only thing that is interesting for us is the ground state of this system, right? Now, if you define the projector as this, right, you can ask, in the context of one chiral fermion, by that I mean this pairing is not there, right? I have broken the chirality, I've taken half of it. One chiral fermion, I can calculate the determinant, and the consistent current is nothing but the derivative of the determinant with respect to the gauge field, which, if it's not gauge invariant, will not be the covariant current, and so there will be two things. This is the consistent that you just get by differentiating, and there is a covariant part of it. They won't be the same. And if you take the exterior derivative of this with gauge field space, then this you can show is just yeah. So the question of anomaly cancellation, which came up yesterday, amounts to whether this is zero or not. And I think what Shailesh was trying to do, now I can say it explicitly, it may, you see, when you have a pair, it will trivially cancel because it will be plus and minus, okay? But if you say you have a non-trivial cancellation of anomalies, like in the standard model, right, then different representations have to make this go to zero, and that need not happen on the finite lattice away from the continuum limit. It may happen only if you go to the continuum limit, right? Then it becomes back to the same problem of Wilson. Wilson broke chiral symmetry to write Wilson fermions, and you have to recover chiral symmetry in the continuum limit. Now we say that the anomaly, even though the representation is anomaly-free in the continuum, it turns out to have a remnant anomaly, which Shailesh yesterday wrote as those extra terms after the FF dual, and those need not exactly cancel unless you do some sort of a semantic improvement program where you keep changing your Wilson operator with more and more terms to cancel everything one by one systematically. It's not going to happen, and you will end up having a remnant lattice anomaly in the before you take the continuum limit, which might cause problems, which I think for some cases, Simon has solved here. He'll talk about it, right? Okay, I'll stop here, and then after the break, I'll continue.